But, you know, it was a massive thing. I can't remember what it was. It was a £4, that's right. Long hair. Then a bit earlier, I saw this thing which, well, a bit of an apology for the dog. It was a dog. And of course, what it was, they said it's a chihuahua. Okay, you take that for a walk, you sort of just, you know, you have to sort of set aside 2 hours to go around what would normally take 10 minutes for the promenade. But you know, you're dealing there with a totally different size, and yet they're both dogs. And artificially, you can obviously breed for those types of creatures. And in the wild, you can to a certain extent breed for different sizes, different hair length, and all the rest of it. And that's not evolution. Evolution tries to maintain that natural selection proves that evolution is true. But if you notice, I've got natural selection in the bottom definition as well. Natural selection isn't particularly the friend of either. Natural selection is just that. It tends to select out of that which is already there. But it does it naturally because of geographical isolation, island groups of finches, like I was mentioning earlier. You know, that is not the same as evolution. Evolution, what I'm saying is when you develop a new function, says that molecules become men, given enough time. Protons even become presidents and prime ministers. And creation is saying no. You have created kinds. Human beings were one of those kinds. Variation, yes, but no common descent. Let me just, I'm going to fly through quite quickly these sets of slides, because I'm going to talk about these creatures today, and then I'm going to talk about these creatures in the rocks. Giraffe, huge long neck, right? Has special muscles to control the blood flow, because otherwise you have a brain hemorrhage every time it stoops to drink. And yet you find giraffe fossils recognizable as giraffes. The only difference is their size, right? So, what's the evolution in that? Well, the answer is there isn't evolution. Basically, in the fossil record, you find fossils of giraffes recognizable as giraffes. Now, I'm going to use the geological column even with the millions of years still in, so forgive me for that. Because most of you here wouldn't accept the millions of years, and neither do I. I've left them in for the sake of the argument, to show you that even if I do accept the millions of years, which is not my position, I believe that most of the fossils were laid down by the flood, that in the so-called geological column, where people say that there's a lot more of it down here, by the way, it doesn't actually start Precambrian. It starts at the the Archean, and then the Hadean, and then eventually comes the Cambrian, the Precambrian, then you come to the Cambrian Ordovician. This is where you tend to get the development of the fossils, these layers. And they say this is over millions of years. Now, let's, for the time being, accept the millions of years. Then I will challenge that a bit later. What do you actually find? Well, giraffes would sit here in the tertiary. And the giraffes have always remained as actually giraffes. There is no evidence of any things which are changing into giraffes. Feathers, which previous to this lecture I have actually, I think, lectured to you on flight, and I've shown you that feathers have this intricate little barbule system where the hooks slide over ridges. You can actually find that feathers are trapped in amber, which is hardened resin, reckoned to be 25 million years old, but actually it's no different to a modern feather. Even the archaeopteryx feathers here, reckoned to be 125 million years old, recognisable like modern feathers. No change in the feathers. That's remarkable. Because here we're dealing with further down in the geological column, where we're finding feathers on archaeopteryx, which are no different to modern feathers. What does that say about the evolution of feathers? There ain't none. There isn't any evolution of feathers. Feathers always were feathers, right? They've remained the same. So you can see the way this first bit is going. I'm not going to give you a talk about insect flight. I'd love to do it. We could talk about the monarch butterfly, the way it comes from valleys in Mexico and goes to the west and to the east, comes up here in San Diego, through San Diego up to Alaska, where I'm going for my 40th wedding anniversary in the summer, which would be nice. But, you know, get monarch butterflies going all the way up there, the western part of Canada, but you also get the eastern part group. But that's not my purpose. What I want to show you is that the intricacy of the butterfly, which is wonderful with its tiny little scales for wings, is actually preserved in the rock here, showing that butterflies haven't changed. This is from Albany State Museum. If you go to the capital of New York State, it's Albany, not New York, of course. And Albany up the Hudson Valley has this wonderful museum, and there in front of you is this fossil of the butterfly. Marvellous. Reckoned to be 50 million years old, but what is the message? Butterflies have remained the same. And by the way, when you look at that butterfly fossil, are you going to get a fossil showing the intricate detail of that wing? What happens to butterflies when they die? Blood stops flowing, you've got a carcass, it disintegrates, such that if mud or stuff was lying on top of it, comes onto it, it will just disintegrate. In other words, you won't get that impression. What does that mean? That means that these flying creatures in particular are showing that they were buried how quickly? Mm-hmm. Exceedingly fast while they were still alive. So that's what that really also shows. Not only have feathers remained the same, but they actually show, fossils show that they were buried quickly. How about this damselfly? I love looking at damselflies. So delicate with their bodies and their wings. There's so much we could say about damselflies, but I'm going to withstand the temptation to give you a talk on them and say there is a fossil damselfly. It's lost one wing, but it's recognisable as a damselfly. And surprise, surprise, it looks identical to a modern damselfly. Where does it sit? Roughly in the same place as the butterflies. Damselflies are no different. And by the way, how do you get a damselfly fossil? How do you get the impression of those wings? Wings which, again, like the butterfly, would disintegrate after a week or so. Just be brittle. How do you get that? You've got to bury it alive. Here's a wonderful one. This is a lacewing moth, where you can actually see the pigment on the wings in this particular example of a moth. Here is the fossil. Look at it. You've got even the impression of the pigment which has come through into the rock. That's again telling you this creature was buried fast, while the pigment was still, as it were, fresh. And able to make an impression on the rock. This is going further down the geological column, and it means that after, supposedly, I don't accept the dates, supposedly 140 million years, lacewing moths have remained the same. These horrible little beasties, mosquitoes, they look identical to today, 46 million year old mosquito. We prefer them dead like that than the live ones we have today. But, you know, that's what they look like. They don't look any different. This fungus gnat doesn't look any different to the gnats that exist today. So there's no change. Dragonflies maybe change in their size. Some have been found with a wingspan of 3 feet, but they're no different to dragonflies today. I got a dragonfly carcass which I found that there was a dead dragonfly just not far from my office, and the wings were open. So I picked it up, put it on the bookcase, and it's sitting there now. But of course it's brittle, such that if I was to put my hand on it, it would just disintegrate. You wouldn't get the impression of that dragonfly in the mud if you buried it now. Again, it's telling you it must have been buried fast. While that creature was alive, apparently, you know, not aware of sudden death coming, sudden death hit it with the mud and everything, squeezing it to death, sadly, and leaving the impression on the rock like that. And this is now a rock which is 320 million years old. Notice I'm going down the geological column, dragonflies have remained the same. Well, you know where we're going next? Go to octopuses. I don't particularly want to meet an octopus while I'm out in the ocean. Octopuses are an amazing creature. They have incredible tentacles, 8 of them, of course. And they have this ability to absorb their enemy by just basically crushing them with their arms, and they feed everything to their mouths, so which is here. So, interestingly, they've got an ink sac, and the ink sac is preserved in some of these fossils, but particularly this fossil was of great impact to the evolutionists who discovered it, because you could even see the sucker marks. There are no real bones in an octopus. It's cartilage as well as flesh. So how do you get that impression? Again, it's telling you that it was buried very, very fast indeed. So the main message is that octopuses have remained the same, or perhaps we should say octopi, and these octopuses also have been buried quickly. This is a king crab. King crab is not that big. Well, you can get them all sizes, but they're usually not much bigger than about 1 foot or 2 foot wide. And in Scotland, there is a tendency to understate things. The English also have a tendency to understate it. They don't always say exactly what they mean. And in the Edinburgh Museum, you can't read that notice, but it actually says this. This is the modern one, this is the Jurassic rock. And it says, although some 150 million years separates it from its Jurassic ancestor shown in this case, it is strikingly similar to that ancient form. Of course, it's strikingly similar. It is the same. There is no difference. Those king crabs look identical to the fossilized ones. And again, one's dealing with something of the order of 150 million years old. Isn't this rather saying something, that if evolution happened, it certainly didn't happen with king crabs? King crabs just appear in the fossil record, and some of them stay as you go through, but others, just other creatures, are just fossilized in one or two layers. Coelacanth is a classic one, because for many years up to 1938, there was the belief that the coelacanth was found in the fossil record, and it was an example of a creature which was gradually coming out of the ocean and changing into an amphibian walking on legs. Until in 1938, people were visiting Madagascar and saw in the fish market what looked distinctly like a coelacanth. They said, "Where did you get this?" I said, "We got it from the ocean. Fished it up." I said, "How long have you been doing this? Doing this for years? Why didn't you come out earlier? We've been getting these for decades, you know, hundreds of years. Our forefathers have been getting them." You see, the foolish idea that the coelacanth was actually only in existence hundreds of millions of years ago and it was gradually changing into something else, all that changed when they found a modern one. So what is that telling me? Well, coelacanths existed then when they were finding them in the rocks, but coelacanths exist today. So over, apparently, 450 million years, this creature has remained the same, no different to what it was. In fact, coelacanths have been found in other parts of the fossil record here. So we know that coelacanths have been busy basically doing nothing except swimming in the bottom of the ocean, as they always have done. And if you were to accept the millions of years, for 400 million years, according to the evolutionary model, they'd be doing nothing to do with evolving, but just simply producing. Every time, every generation, they'd be producing what? Coelacanths. And then the next generation produces a coelacanth. And the next generation has produced a coelacanth. And so it's going on, coelacanth, coelacanth, all the way down the line. It's a bit like turtles all the way down. This is coelacanths all the way up. So I don't accept the millions of years, but if you were to accept the millions of years, what actually do you have? Coelacanths for millions of years. Coelacanths have remained the same. So we've gone through all those things and we've said, been no evidence of evolution. You know what the evolutionists will say? You've cherry-picked. What about the creatures that we don't have today? Well, let's come to them. Let's come to dinosaurs and let's come to trilobites. Now, trilobites are interesting creatures. I'm going to look at those first because it's a bit difficult to bring along a pet fossilized dinosaur, particularly if they're big ones. But there are fossilized dinosaurs. Now, according to evolution, this is your great, 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 great uncle. So if you're an evolutionist, you have to treat this with care because this is related to you. But as dinosaurs, apparently, as cousins. We're going to look at trilobites which existed, according to the evolutionist, 450 to 500 million years ago in the Ordovician and some of them in the Cambrian rock. Now, what I'm going to actually do here is not say, we've got a trilobite here in the rock, we've got a modern trilobite. I can't bring a modern trilobite because I don't have one. Every indication seems to be that these trilobites don't exist anymore. However, we might yet find one, I guess, at the bottom of the Pacific, crawling around, minding its own business. That would be great if it did. But we don't, at the moment, have trilobites. But trilobites, what I am able to talk about is their amazing complexity. You've heard perhaps people refer to the so-called, quote, Cambrian explosion, unquote. That is when people who are a little bit sucked into the evolutionary mindset so strongly that they can't think of any other way for explaining the origin of creatures, are a little bit surprised that when they actually look at the Cambrian and Ordovician rock, that they find very sophisticated creatures. They say, where did these come from? Because when we dig further down to the pre-Cambrian and below, we don't find any development of these creatures. So where did they come from? And so they say, well, it's a sort of an explosion of life. You know, must have been very fast evolving in evolution in those days. Now I want to actually show you what are the sophistications in trilobites. Well, the sophistication in trilobites is their eyes. The eyes of trilobites are actually what give the real price to these fossils that you can buy off them, usually from North Africa. I doubt that this particular one was very expensive. I can't remember. Probably only about $30 or $40 or thereabouts. But ones like the ones in the pictures here are actually going to be of the order of $2,000 or $3,000 to get an eye that good. As you can see, the one on the top left there, you can clearly see the eye. The eye is a compound eye. Compound eye means that the eye is composed of lots and lots of little lenses, hundreds of them, all lined up, all actually seeing an individual image. The fly that you swatted the other day in warm, balmy San Diego was actually also a creature with a compound eye. But the difference is that the eye of a dragonfly or the eye of a fly, common housefly, had lenses, the one that you swatted, made of protein that we were talking about in the first talk. Whereas the eye of a trilobite has individual lenses, hundreds of them, made out of mineral. It's the only creature known to have eyes made of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate is a crystal, and yet each one of those lenses, as you can see on that particular trilobite eye blown up there so that you can see it, has lenses which are convex and clearly have a middle point, the center point of each lens. Now, we'll part that point about the center point or the center line through which the line of sight goes through. But remember that it does have a line of sight. Each one of those lenses has a central line through which the creature would have seen through that lens. What you're now looking at, and which I'm going to pass round, sorry, it's got a little bit tatty having travelled a few thousand miles, is a lump of calcite. That calcite, as you can see on the screen, and the calcite coming round, has got a double image. Why does it have a double image? The reason is that light comes in two polarizations. Sunlight, or the light coming from these electric lights here, is actually coming with a polarization in one plane and another polarization in a different plane, right? So you've got light coming in one plane, so that it's all coming in horizontally like that. Then the other bit of the light is coming in the vertical plane. Calcite, which is calcium carbonate, is transparent. So it acts like glass, and it bends the light. Water also bends light. There's lots of materials transparent to, of course, bend the light. But calcium carbonate bends the light in two different ways. We call it birefringent. It refracts the light according to its polarization. So if it's horizontal light, it bends at one angle, but if it's vertical light, it bends at a different angle. So if you had polarized lenses, you'd actually see one image, and then you'd see a different image. Here you got it. Now, here is a polarized lens put on top of a lump of calcite, which is sitting over some words underneath, right? And as I turn the polarized lens round, the polarized lens picks up one polarization, and then it picks up the other polarization. So you actually see one image and then another image, which demonstrates the fact that you've got two different polarizations being bent at two separate angles. So the question now comes to you. Were Humble trilobites seeing double? And the answer is no, for the following reason. Because every one of those lenses has a special property. And I need to tell you one last thing about this lump of calcite. This lump of calcite that I was showing you earlier, this one, there is one line, the angle of which to the surface will determine its latitude angle, right? And the rotation angle of that line we call the azimuthal angle. So I'm using strict terminology here, but you don't need to worry too much about the terms that I've used. But the point I'm making is that not only do you have to get the right angle to the plane of the crystal, you've also got to get the right rotation angle. And once you've got it, you'll find that those two images will come together if you look down that axis. Now I come back to that little point that I parked in your mind earlier. Remember I talked about all these lenses, and they have a center line, a line of sight. Guess which line that line of sight is lined up to. Exactly the line that I've just mentioned. It's this special axis, which is such that when you look down that axis, you don't get two images, right? So those lenses are rather like someone having sort of carved out a special lens, which is at a very odd angle to the actual calcite. It's not an obvious angle at all. And everything is indicating those lenses have been placed in exactly the right position, no doubt by some sort of program in the original DNA of trilobites, which actually made sure that calcite was generated in the body and formed these lenses. But it is an amazing feat of engineering that they're all lined up correctly. Not only that, even if the lenses were made of glass, there would still be another issue. You know what happens if you have fat lenses? They tend to cause rainbow colours on the edges, don't they? you get what the technical term is, chromatic aberration. So you have to correct for that in telescope lenses and in binocular lenses and all sorts of optics. No, people know about this in optical engineering. And Descartes and Huygens, two people in separate countries, developed special shapes which they knew would actually get rid of chromatic aberration. But would you believe it? When the trilobite eyes were taken out of the trilobite fossils, these little lenses placed in a laboratory, laser passed through them, guess which shape they had? They had either Descartes shapes or Huygens shapes. In other words, they were shaped specially to avoid chromatic aberration. Exquisite optical engineering. And are we really saying then that trilobites evolved? I would suggest to you now, these trilobites are showing great evidence that they were sophisticated creatures. Well, what about dinosaurs? Dinosaurs come in all sorts of shapes and forms. Some of them were big, like this T-Rex, which I wouldn't have liked to have met on a dark night or a light day. I think I would have actually liked to have gone a few miles away from them. But were they necessarily always carnivorous? According to the Bible, they wouldn't necessarily be carnivorous. But they certainly were carnivorous by the time a lot of them were buried, mostly, I would say, in the flood. Actually, you get small ones as well as large ones, but there certainly were large ones, as we find in the sediments. You can actually find huge footprints of dinosaurs. But the argument that I want to now use to argue that actually dinosaurs weren't in the business of changing into something else is that, slightly different to what I said about trilobites. With trilobites, I was basically saying the sheer complexity of those eyes, with no precursors in the Precambrian and the earlier rock, shows very clearly that trilobites weren't evolving. They were actually creatures in their own right, which we don't have today, which were very, very sophisticated in their optics. What is the argument then that I use about dinosaurs? A slightly different argument. Because you see, people tried to make out that the dinosaurs were busy changing into something else. Were they really changing into something else? Because what are the something else's? Well, you've got other creatures which are buried in the layers with the dinosaurs. If the dinosaurs were busy changing into something else over millions of years, how come buried with the dinosaurs are creatures which weren't busy changing into something else? Here in this picture in Spain, you could see that from the caption, 8,000 fossils were found, all of dinosaurs of the same type, buried with creatures which you wouldn't normally expect those creatures to be buried with. What was going on here? Plant-eating dinosaurs live on land and would eat plants on land. Where do crocodiles live? Generally, I would suggest to you that crocodiles are living by the marshes, living by the waters, living near rivers. And you well know that they love to float around, you know, with their eyes just above the water, ready for the next creature to catch, or human being for that matter. And they will be pretty nasty, as we know. So those creatures, those crocodiles, are not generally thought of as living with plant-eating dinosaurs. How come that they got buried with them then? Also, even turtles, which do live in the water, they were buried with them as well. So we need to ask some questions. How come that there was 8,000 fossils all buried together of dinosaurs? What was going on here? Dinosaurs, it certainly seems from the record, were in existence, but they no longer exist today. They have become extinct. So we no longer have them. But buried with those 8,000 fossils of dinosaur were crocodiles, which we have today, which are fearsome, horrible-looking creatures, but just as fearsome in the fossils as they are today. Look at this massive one found out in the Sahara Desert. And these fossilized crocodiles are no different in essence to crocodiles that we have today. So that argument is well established, that we have crocodiles which haven't changed in the fossil record from the creatures that we have today. My point is that the dinosaurs were found with creatures which we do have today. So the implication I'm suggesting is that if you're going to build a whole argument on dot-billed dinosaurs and other dinosaurs changing, how come they're buried with creatures which weren't changing? And also, what is the strong suggestion as well is that the crocodiles may have been changing in size, but you're now going to say that dinosaurs were busy changing. Well, where is the evidence, really, that they were changing into something else? Because you actually find the dinosaurs living and moving amongst other creatures, eating them, obviously some of them eating plants, eating vegetation, but you don't find any half creatures after that. Well, maybe we need to look at radioactive dating, because people say, well, we know that those creatures were buried millions of years ago. Well, do we know that? Actually, I don't think we do, because with any radioactive dating clock, you need to know what was the parent element, how much you had of it in the past, and what was the rate of change of that element as it was changing into the daughter element. Those are what we call radioactive clocks. People try to make out that they do know that the radioactive decay constant has been the same, and that they do know what was there in the beginning in terms of how much parent element was there in the fossil record, in the actual fossil. Sorry, in the rock, I should say. Now, that's a fairly complicated slide, so I've just summarised it here. We need to realise that there are two major assumptions in radiometric dating. You need to know the rate of decay. Has that changed in the past? And you need to know the initial conditions. Once you know the initial conditions, once you know the rate of decay, then you can use it, it is said, as a predictive tool or as a deductive tool as to how old the rock was. Because if we know how much per kilogram there was of the parent element, and now we've got so much per kilogram left, then it would mean that there has been a gradual decay from the conditions when they were buried to the conditions today. Just to illustrate this point, here's Tim and John in the bath, and John's showing how brilliant he is, telling Tim how long it took for Mother to fill the bath. And he says to Tim, I reckon it took 2 hours, 43 minutes. And Tim is very impressed, and John says, well, I know it took two hours, 47 minutes, because I've worked out how long it took from empty with the tap flowing at its present rate to get to the level where we are now. Was he right or was he wrong? Actually, he was wrong. Because when he asked Mum about how long it took to run the bath, Mum said, oh, it took about half an hour. He says, it couldn't have taken half an hour. I just worked it out. There's 2 hours, 43 minutes. You've got to have got it wrong, Mum. Mum says, no, you're wrong, John. Because I had the bath tap running very, very fast to begin with, and then I turned it down. Do you see the analogy to radioactive dating? The decay constant, supposedly constant, wasn't constant, and that there was fast radioactive decay in the past, right? And the other thing Mum says, I didn't start with the bath empty. The bath was half full, having bathed baby Jane first. At which point, both boys got out indignantly and said, we're not getting bathed in dirty water. But you get the point, the initial conditions aren't known. People say they know how much of the parent isotope was there in the rocks, but you don't know how much was there in the beginning, because nobody was there to observe. And there are huge discrepancies, like this wood buried in rock, which is supposedly millions of years old, from basalt, which is molten volcanic rock, and wood entombed within the basalt is dated using carbon-14 schemes to be 44,000 years. Well, that's not a biblical timescale. That is much more than a biblical timescale. But it's much less than your 45 million years old. So you see that there is a discrepancy here, a large discrepancy, telling you that there is something wrong in the radioactive dating. This is a wonderful example from Reading in northern part of this state, up near the border with Oregon. Al Franklin has a wonderful collection of fossils, Pastor Al Franklin, and I actually saw some of them this summer. Both fossils here, the fossilized wood, is clearly connected with the ammonite. But the wood, if you were to date it, would date using carbon-14 as thousands of years. But the ammonite, which it clearly is encased in, dates to be 120 million years old. Something big time wrong. Something's very wrong with the dating schemes. And how about this? We find... Yeah, sorry. Let me just now play you... that was a signal for me to play you something else. Get rid of Microsoft's words. Keep on telling me things I don't want to know. That is... Oh, I see, sorry. Okay, here we go. Now, I'm going to play this. This is a little interlude.
Really, every textbook in science is connected.
Sorry, my DVDs have gone wrong. Dear. I had this all set up. Sorry about this. I have to restart it, I think that looks right.
Nearly every textbook in Science magazine teaches that the Earth is billions of years old, and the primary dating method used for determining this is what is called radioisotope dating, or radiometric dating. Now, this is a reliable method for measuring absolute ages of rocks and the age of the Earth, right? First of all, many scientists now regard the age of the Earth to be between 4.55 and 4.6 billion years old. Okay, so if this method is reliable and accurate, why the 50 million year discrepancy? That seems like a lot, but let's get into some details here and see what's going on. Keep in mind, there's all kinds of scientific jargon on this topic, and so we'll just present a very straightforward, simplified version of the process. Radiometric dating is the process of estimating the ages of rocks based on the decay of radioactive elements in them. Basically, there are certain kinds of atoms in nature that are unstable and spontaneously decay into other kinds of atoms. For instance, uranium will radioactively decay through a series of steps until it becomes the stable element called lead. The original element is called the parent element, and the end result is called the daughter element. Radioisotope dating is commonly used to date igneous rocks, rocks which formed when hot molten material cooled and solidified. The dating clock started when the rock cooled. During the molten state, it is assumed that the intense heat forced any gaseous daughter elements to escape. It is assumed that once the rock cooled, No more atoms escape, and any daughter element now found in the rock is a result of radioactive decay since that rock formed. The decay rate is measured in terms of half-life. That is the length of time it takes half of the remaining atoms of a radioactive parent element to decay. Now, of course, that can be measured in a laboratory, and it is assumed that since we know the decay rate, we can calculate backwards and come up with the age of the rock. But is that all there is to it? Here's where it gets tricky. It's true you can measure a decay rate using observational science, but there's another kind of science that is required to accurately calculate dates for rocks, and that is what we call historical science. Historical science deals with the things in the past, and therefore cannot be repeated and tested. Dating methods require both types of science, because in order to get accurate rock dates, one would have to accurately know both the decay rate and the initial conditions of the rock sample, right? Since radioisotope dating uses both types of science, we can't directly measure the ages of rocks. There are assumptions involved. For instance, how do we know what the initial conditions were in the rock sample? How do we know the amounts of parent or daughter elements now in that sample haven't been altered by other processes in the past? How does someone know the decay rate has remained constant since the rock formed? The answer is, they don't. Let's simplify here and talk about a typical hourglass. Let's say you walk into a room and you see an hourglass with sand at the top and sand at the bottom, and some sand sprinkling from the top chamber to the bottom. Well, observational science would allow us to see and measure the sand, and then calculate how long the hourglass has been running, right? We could make our sand measurements and then calculate when the hourglass was turned over, right? Well, those calculations could be wrong, because we may have failed to consider some major assumptions, like, was there any sand at the bottom when the hourglass was turned over? Has any sand been added or taken out of the hourglass? Has the sand always been falling at a constant rate? Since we did not observe the initial conditions when the hourglass started, and we haven't been watching the sand all the time since then, we must make assumptions. All three of those assumptions can affect our time calculations. Now, of course, there's more to understanding all of this, but that's it.
You can actually get hold of those DVDs if you want them. I'm afraid that I haven't got them with me on this particular talk, but you can get them from Answers in Genesis. Now look, let me just close off by actually mentioning an amazing bit of evidence. T-Rex has been found with soft tissues in it. Did you know that? In the fossilized bones of a femur of a T-Rex bone, Mary Schweitzer from Montana State University, she's moved now I think to another university, but at that point she was with Jack Corner at Montana State University, and found since not just T-Rex bones but lots of other dinosaurs, taken the bones and looked inside the marrow inside the bones and found that it's soft. That it isn't fossilized. In other words, the outer part's fossilized, but the inside has got stuff like meat, which you could put into a microwave and have a T-Rex steak. So you could even see blood vessels in them. So what is this saying? Probably not 65 million years old. You know, Mary Schweitzer and Jack Horner have maintained, well, it's just amazing how the blood vessels have stayed in like that for 65 million years. Well, of course, they're bound to say that, aren't they? But isn't that really due to really presuppositions in their mindsets? In other words, both people can look at the same evidence and draw very different conclusions. And here comes the rub. Other bones of similar creatures, not the ones with soft tissue at the moment, but I'll come back to that. Other dinosaur bones have been dated using carbon-14. Now, it didn't bring it out in the little video clip that we've just seen, but the half-life of carbon-14 is not measured in millions of years. Remember what it said in that video? It's the time taken for the initial amount to reduce to half the amount. If you do it again, it reduces to a quarter of the amount. If you do it again, it reduces to an eighth of the amount. Do it again, reduces to 16th, do it again, reduces to 32nd. If you do that 10 times over, it reduces to 1 over 1,024, to be exact, for the computer scientists here. If you do it for 20 times, it becomes 1 over 1,024 times 1 over 1,024. Do you see where I'm going? 10 half-lives gives you roughly 1,000th. 20 half-lives gives you 1 millionth. By the time most people say once you get to 1 millionth, you basically lost all that was there to begin with. It's barely possible to find any trace of the original radioisotope. If you've got a half-life which is as fast as 5,730 years, which carbon-14 is, carbon-14 changes to nitrogen, and it, the amount of time it takes to reduce half to half the original value is 5,730 years, right? What's 20 times 5,730 years? Roughly 110,000 years. Friday evening, a bit late for you to be doing calculations like that, so I'll do it for you. So 110,000 years is actually a maximum possible for any carbon-14 found in any of the rocks. If you find carbon-14, whatever the initial conditions, because they're right, the initial condition problem still applies to carbon-14, but you know that it cannot be older than 20 half-lives, if you find any at all, right? Would you believe it? Coal has produced a positive signal of carbon-14 in it. I haven't got that on the slide here. I'm dealing with dinosaur bones. And dinosaur bones recently have been tested and have come out with a positive reading of carbon-14. The evolutionist says it must be contamination. That wears a bit thin when it's case after case after case after case, which is showing positive readings of carbon-14. Now, it's true, the evolutionists haven't done this, and they've actually refused to do anything to actually verify the findings of what the creation community have found. Just listen to this. This is Bob Enyard from KLTT Radio interviewing Jack Horner, who was the mentor of Mary Schweitzer, who found the soft tissue.
This is Bob Enyard with KLTT Radio in Denver, Colorado. That's Bob Enyard.
Yeah, let me transfer you over to his office. I think he should be in there right now.
Yep. Hello, Jack. This is Bob Enyard with KLTT Radio in Denver.
Uh-huh.
How are you doing?
Good.
Jack, I sent a letter to Bob Harmon a few weeks back offering the museum a grant of $8,000 to do a carbon-14 date test of that soft tissue T-Rex you guys dug up. And he said he would forward that to you. And I'm wondering if you saw that or considered it.
Well, Herman-14 doesn't work on something that old.
I understand that, and normally we wouldn't expect to get soft tissue out of a T-Rex skeleton either, but sometimes science proceeds by crossing your T's and dotting your I's, and you guys might have other things you'd like to carbon-14 at the same time. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, I've been able to raise a little more money, so that's up to $10,000 now, that we'd be honored to give you guys if you would consider doing that test.
Well, we can't do that test.
You can't do that?
No.
Do you mean the museum doesn't have the laboratory?
We certainly don't.
Okay, well, we're happy to pay the expense of having a lab do the test in addition to the $10,000 to the museum.
Do you know how carbon-14 works?
Yeah, I'm familiar, and I realize it's useless for anything over maybe 50,000 years or so. But I've done a talk show in Denver for 15 years, and there's a group of folks interested in science. Of course, that discovery caught their attention, and they thought, well, it'd be logical to do this, to just go ahead and do it, even though nobody would be inclined to do it, just like nobody would be inclined to look for soft tissue inside of a T-Rex.
Well, no, and, you know, we're still trying to figure out what it is, what it's actually made of.
Right, exactly, whether it's hemoglobin or whatever. Jack, is the amount too small that it's just not worth the consideration?
No, that's not it.
Okay. What if I were able to raise more money?
No, that, the amount of money has nothing to do with it. Because carbon-14 doesn't work on something like this,
right,
your results that you get could be all over the place.
Well, they should be infinity. It should be not datable. In other words, it shouldn't come back saying it's 25,000 years old.
Right.
It should be infinity. And so that would be worth
it. Well, infinity isn't exactly what you get.
Okay.
I mean, it's like trying to date a piece of concrete.
Right.
You have to have carbon in it.
Right. You wouldn't use carbon-14. Now, the skeleton is not fossilized. Isn't that true, or largely not?
Well, the bone is made of calcium phosphate. Like I say, we're still trying to figure out what the actual soft tissue is.
Right, and see, we were hoping that a test like this would just add another bit of scientific information that you would have at your disposal. And also, in that grant letter, we asked if it could be a blind test with 5 different specimens, and therefore then the museum could test 4 other specimens that you might want to have carbon-14 dated, and so you could put it all in the same batch, and those testing then will pay the cost of that. That'll be free to the museum plus the $10,000 grant.
Let me tell you where I'm coming from here.
Sure.
All right. Obviously, your group is a group of creationists.
Yes.
And the spin they can get off of it,
right,
doing it, is
wow. So I think you get the drift, don't you? I won't play any more, but there's more of it. And there is a second interview, which I won't play now. But you see really what's going on here is that those guys don't even want to test at all. Because if they do test, it's actually engaging with those with whom they strongly disagree concerning the presuppositions they bring to the evidence, okay? Right? That's number one. And number two, although they feel very strongly that those rocks are millions of years old, they know full well that if they do get a positive reading of carbon-14, and they don't Jack was doing his level best to skirt around that point, but they know that if they do get a reading, that has a possible implication that it really is a genuine reading, and that it really is indicating that those dinosaur bones are of the order of thousands of years, not 65 million years old. So there are two real reasons there, which is basically amounts to prejudice. So what really do the rocks say? Well, the answer is, just as this fish eating another fish, this ichthyosaur in the process of giving birth to another ichthyosaur, what's it say? Catastrophe. Snapshot in time is being shown. So basically, whatever the creature was doing, suddenly it was hit by an underground sort of subterranean amount of muck and sediment which hit it, buried it, sadly killed it, and fossilized it. That is what really the rocks are telling us. Massive burial catastrophe. What does that show me? That this book, which speaks about the worldwide flood, is actually true. That's really what the rocks are saying. There's even a squid found with its ink, which was fossilized with it, and that squid ink was put into a pen and used, right? The powder was made into ink, which was usable. That was indicating, of course, again, catastrophe. You could actually use the ink. Catastrophe was indicated by all the fossils that I've been mentioning. They're not millions of years old. They're actually all examples of catastrophe. The obvious contender is the worldwide flood. The book, the Bible, says in 2 Peter 3, the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. That's what Jack Horner is afraid of. Mm-hmm. Deep down. He won't admit it. He probably doesn't even admit it to himself. But actually, that's what the evolutionists know is where we're going. They know that the creation stroke flood model leads to the belief and the conviction that this book is true. Once you've got this book true, then it means that it's teaching on the Ten Commandments, it's teaching on the judgment, it's teaching on redemption, it's teaching on the importance of the Lord Jesus Christ as the only saviour from sin, that is true as well. And that's what man, in his natural state, hates. That's what's going on. The battle is not over evidence. The battle is on interpretation of evidence. We'll be saying a little bit more about that tomorrow. For those of you coming to this church, you're welcome. Service at 11:15, where I'll be speaking on Romans 11:36. But if you're from another church, you go to your own church tomorrow, let me say this, if you want to know more about these things, get hold of the literature. Get a hold of my book, Genesis for Today. Get hold of the other books which are there, the DVDs. They're only available there on that bookstore. You won't get them in the San Diego bookshop, at least I don't think you will. I have been there and I don't think they have the creation literature there. But, so you're welcome to buy up the literature here. I'm not making money out of it. AIG's not making much out of it, to be frank. We're really far more concerned about getting the material into good hands and being read and watched. So may the